All right. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Good morning to those on the West Coast. I hope everyone had a wonderful and relaxing Memorial weekend and were able to unplug for a bit. I think it was a appropriate time for everyone. I'll kick it off real quick. We'll try to jump right into it. I'm going to allow our in-house counsel, John Fielding, say a couple things on the antitrust, and we're going to kick it off to the Joels for a brief political update. And then I will launch a poll on 6 or 7 topics that we heard from feedback from the group. So thanks to all that sent in topics and suggestions for today's conversations. Feel free to select as many as you'd like. I believe you can select more than one, and we'll just approach the topics in that order. If there's anything you'd like to discuss, or if you have a question you'd like to post without going direct to the group, you can comment it in the chat box, and we'll try to approach those either as we go or at the end of the conversation. And just to let everyone know, this is recorded, but it'll only be shared internally to folks in the working group and used for the recap. For those that cannot attend today's meeting, we'll post it on the Basecamp group as well. If you're not familiar with their Basecamp group, it allows peers to share resources, post questions. Please reach out to me directly and I'll send you an invite to that group. It's been a great resource throughout this time. We'll also post the recordings on there. And one other thing that I had a couple working group members reach out to me was regarding our state trackers and some of our Steptoe resources. Steptoe is our legal partner. We partner with Steptoe & Johnson in DC, and they do a wonderful job providing state-by-state trackers on insurance regulations, COVID regulations, and all sorts. So I will post that in the group as well, but just wanted to bring that to everyone's attention as well. I see that Joel Wood and Joel Copperud are on. So John Fielding, I will turn it to you.
Great. Thanks a lot, Rob. Good afternoon, everybody. I hope everyone's doing well. Just wanted to make sure that everyone knows that the meeting is going to be held in compliance with the council's antitrust policy. In particular, we have to remember that council activities, including this meeting, won't include any actions expressed or implied or formal or informal to raise or stabilize prices for insurance products, including level of agent commissions, to boycott or refuse to deal with third parties, or to allocate product or geographic markets. We can't make comments about any specific company practices or specific geographic markets or future trip place. I'll be on the call today, and we'll monitor to make sure the conversation doesn't veer in the wrong direction. And Rob, if I could just add, unofficially just add a couple words about the state trackers. They are on our website on the COVID page. They're not behind the firewall. We tried to keep track of everything, of all the state regulatory pronouncements and guidance that's going on. We're keeping track of the closings and now the opening, rules and emergency orders, and as well as some of the legislation on business interruption and workers' compensation and things like that. So there's a lot of information on the website on that stuff. Thanks.
Great. Thank you so much, John. I'll turn it over to Joel Copperud and Joel Wood, our two in-house lobbyists. I'm not sure if Blair is on the line, but she may chime in. Feel free to post questions through the chat. If we cannot get anything, we'll be happy to circle back after the call. But thanks, Joel Copperud and Joel Wood, for joining us.
Sure. Joel, you want to take it?
Sure. Thanks very much. Blair, I'm a little worried about, because she twisted her ankle last night. She said it was just a sprain, but she also said she hurt it. And so she's at the dock right now. So I know what a broken ankle feels like. So I hope everyone is doing well and you all had a good Memorial Day holiday. So happy Blur's Day as they run together. So Rob asked us to keep it really brief to about 10 minutes. And hopefully if you're reading the daily newsletter, you're pretty much up to speed. The sort of news development that I found of interest today, I never conceived that I would be so interested in what a lower court initial coverage dispute ruling in Paris, France, would be so interesting to me. But AXA lost last Friday the first round coverage dispute on the same sort of civil authority. I think when we look at, obviously, country to country and company to company and market to market, heavily scripted all the way down to BOPs. I think in the SME space, what we typically see is a lot of consistency on all that intersection of direct property damage, civil authority intervention, and obviously viral contagion. So AXA lost on the civil authority issue. We talked this morning to our counterpart in London, and he said that it's not unusual for France, but likewise, a hotel, this was a restaurant closing, and I don't know the insurer yet, but I'm told that an insurer in Germany last week also lost an initial thing. And the news today was that AXA, after last week saying, well, that's just one court, we're going to take this on. AXA this morning said that they do intend to pay similarly situated customers. Again, what the relevance of all that is, you know, and certainly our legal system is one in which nothing's going to happen. I wouldn't anticipate we'd be seeing broad rulings or seeing resolution on anything in months, maybe not even in years. The other thing that I find interesting on the international front is that again, not having the sort of contingency fee based litigation based situation here, is that in the UK, the regulators, the FCA, are trying to bundle together a number of different types of coverage issues and take them to the courts for a preemptive ruling as early as June, which our colleague thinks that's a little too optimistic as well. I just find all of that to be really interesting. On the legislative side, and I'll hand it over to you, Joel, we've been struggling to get oxygen on this recovery fund idea. When you look at just sort of the back and forth of the CARES 2.0 that the House has passed, the $3.2 trillion additional money with this, and the Senate is not in session this week. The House is going to be in session, but deploying proxy voting. The one thing that I find that I think is going to have a favorable result. But the question is whether or not it's going to happen this week or when the Senate actually comes back in, is a lot of the hospitality industry has been fighting really hard for the PPP dollars to have more latitude in the forbearance. And so that seems to be a bipartisan sentiment. The Senate has already sort of negotiated a bipartisan agreement on this, but has not passed it. The House is going to pass it this week. The question is whether or not they will incorporate the Senate stuff so that we can expedite that process. And with that, Joel, I will hand over to you as to the broader prospects for liquidity legislation and whether or not the House and the Senate in this environment can come together. Thanks.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So we, on one hand, to your point, like we're struggling getting oxygen to it a little bit. We don't have a bill yet. We've got two different iterations of it that are floated in the House and the Senate, but there's still no bill number yet. And that's because complications with the PPP and offices trying to focus on first getting the PPP functional and getting the money into the people that need it. So they don't want to divert their attention from fixing the PPP. And then second is we're working closely with the policyholder community, and we need this to be viewed as a policyholder issue and a policyholder priority. Well, their priorities are a little splintered right now because they're also focused on the PPP and trying to get that work, get that to work. So it's a little stalled, but I don't think that it's over. And if you look at the momentum, so all the noise is on fixing the PPP, but you're seeing a lot of momentum being generated around alternatives to the PPP, whether it's the Paycheck Guarantee Act, as floated by Senators Warner, and Pramila Jayapal and like 90 other Democrats in the House. Cory Gardner, a handful of Republicans are pitching this other alternative that's similar to the Paycheck Guarantee Act. And then we've got our recovery fund. Senator Daines is keen to drop the recovery fund, his version of the recovery fund, and he wants to do it alongside with a Democrat. So he hasn't dropped it until he gets a Democratic dance partner on this. So we're working to find that that person. We're hoping that's going to be Chris Van Hollen, but there's a whole bunch of other senators on committee that would be great for that. So we're a little stalled, but we're still moving forward. And, you know, some of the conversations that we've had on the Hill about the recovery fund, the pushback we'll get, or that it's commonly referred to as the slush fund. They're like, oh, so is this the slush fund you're talking about? Because there's no score to it. It's pretty open-ended, whereas PPP was just an X amount of dollars. And, you know, on one hand, the answer is, yeah, it is a slush fund. But on the other hand, we're sending them all this data that demonstrates the cost of acting in this direction or the cost of doing nothing. And the cost of doing nothing with lost GDP, higher unemployment rates, small businesses closing down, 40 to 50% of small businesses closing, is significant. So even though we don't have a cost, we can point to what a lot of economists show what inaction is going to look like. So that's kind of our talking point on the recovery fund right now. So I would look for, you know, some more action on that in the next week or so. And then, you know, we've got PREA. And of course, this is the Pandemic Risk Insurance Act. That was supposed to be introduced last week. It's now going to be dropped today. Actually, there's a press conference at 3:30 where Congresswoman Maloney is going to drop it with her, I think, about 20 co-sponsors. So be prepared for some press on PREA tomorrow and this week. We, of course, as you know, came out and endorsed the Pandemic Risk Association Act, but Insurance Act, but that's just simply because it is consistent with our principles of being part of the solution and trying to mitigate any more economic damage from a future pandemic. Our priorities are always going to be with our policyholders. So if we can find a viable solution to get some kind of coverage for the policyholder community, we're for it. So PREA is what is closest to being introduced now. The carriers are floating. I don't know if they have a champion yet, but they're floating their own proposal, which is looks a lot more like the National Flood Insurance Program. It is 100% funded by FEMA, or operated through FEMA, 100% funded by the government. There's no carrier risk in their proposal. And it's going to be interesting to see how the two play out, because there's clearly two sides to this story. But, you know, the Congresswoman Maloney will tell you that she's got House leadership on her side for the PREA. I would look at the Financial Services Committee to probably mark something up within the next couple of months with the hopes of adding this to some kind of stimulus package, if there is one, probably later in the summer. But that's, you know, the congressional, that said, later in the summer, the congressional schedule is really up in the air right now. You know, traditionally, they would do a 4th of July recess. They'd be in recess this week. They would go in recess for 4 weeks in August. It's a presidential election. They would allow time to campaign in October. I mean, right now, we would probably be telling you that there are 40 legislative days left this year to get a laundry list done. Right now, we don't know. So the schedule is now totally out the window. The House is coming in this week. They'll probably not go on recess in August. They still have a huge laundry list to get done, aside from all the COVID stuff. So it's hard to say what a time frame looks like for a prospective solution. But the stakeholder community on this is 100% divided today. That's not to say we'll be divided in a month, because the conversations are going to start in earnest once the bill's introduced. And we're going to be part of that. But keep your eyes on that. And then I would point to benefits. We're talking about liquidity. We're talking about keeping clients' head above water. But the long-term threats to ESI with these unemployment rates above 20% are significant. So we've got, you know, we had a lot of anxiety pre-COVID about public option, momentum behind a public option, any potential Democratic administration and Democratic Congress. I think that anxiety has significantly increased given the economic situation. And to try to mitigate that, we're trying to just right now keep as many people from falling off their employer-sponsored plans as possible. So the first priority with that is COBRA and getting federal subsidies for people to stay on COBRA. The House passed bill, was that last week? Their days are all running together. Included 100% subsidies for COBRA policies to keep people on their plans. We know that that's going to be an administrative nightmare for brokers to track down these employees to get them the subsidies if they want them. But whatever, there's the subsidies are there, so they could technically stay on. So that should mitigate some of the migration from ESI to public plans, if we can get that in. Senate Republicans, they are for subsidies. They are not at the 100% figure yet. They commonly point to, they understand that following the Great Recession, Congress passed 65% subsidies for COBRA plans. And they recognize that that's not enough in this environment, but they're not at the 100% level yet. And they also continue to point to Hyde Amendment issues, with the federal, with the subsidies. And as we mentioned before, the issue is, they commonly point to the stat that 40% of employer plans offer the coverage for abortion procedures, and about 27% of employees opt for those plans. To subsidize those plans would be illegal. So how do we get around that? For some reason, the conversations I've been a part of, they have not found the channel to get around that. Now, they've clearly got around it in 2009 when they passed a 65% subsidy. So I can't imagine, given the momentum for subsidies on both sides of the aisle in both chambers, that this doesn't get done. But there's still, the Hyde issue continues to pop up. So we'll see how that shakes out. Hopefully we'll have some more intel on that in the next week or two. Joel, what did I miss?
We have gone over our time, but you covered the landscape really well. Heather just asked whether or not the Munich Re product would have covered COVID-19. And we did. I did note, we're talking a prospective pandemic proposal. It's a cluster within the industry. And it took 14 months after 9/11 before TRIA was passed. And we're talking about a pandemic yet to come. So I'm less optimistic than you that this will be, that this has traction for potential enactment. I've also heard mixed things, Heather, as to whether any of that Munich Re product was actually sold. I know that Marsh was marketing it. I know that, you know, Wimbledon had coverage, but that was for event cancellation. And so I've heard very mixed things about that. And then just an absolute final point, because Rob, I know you're going nuts that we've gone so far over. I continue to believe that notwithstanding all of the press that it gets, and there's going to be a hearing in the Louisiana State Senate tomorrow about retrospective coverage, I think the action is now in the courts, and I don't have concerns that there is going to be any enactment of retrospective coverage. So with that, unless there's anything else you need to add, Joel, Rob, we'll get out of your way, and I apologize, but I will say, without Zoom, and I miss seeing a lot of your faces, so I'm grateful to get a chance to see you.
Great. Thanks so much, Joel. If anyone has any quick questions, feel free to chime in. But we will move forward with the poll, going to launch it. And you should see a number of topics come up, and I'll elaborate on them briefly. Feel free to interrupt me with any questions for the Joels. But we asked the group to reach out with any topics, trending topics, what we like to call emerging trends, something that maybe has surfaced around your organization since our last conversation. And thank you to those who did get back with a couple topics. The first one, I believe we may have missed one, or if it's not in the same order, but I believe there's 22 states that are in some version of phase two right now. Many other states are looking at June 1. So we've seen some progress since our last conversation. So we had a couple of folks reach out about how we're working with clients to begin to reopen, liability, uncertainties, guidelines, best practices. That's kind of touching on our conversation 2 weeks ago, but I'm happy to continue that. Second, communication strategies with clients and their customers. How can you set best expectations for clients before reopening? For brokerages not opening up, depending on the size of the brokerage or where you are in the country, how are you pivoting and offering remote services, remote safety inspections, checklists, claims handling? And for those that brokerages that are beginning to update or to open, how are you internally working with employee travel and on-site visits? I know Michael and Jen, who will also help lead this discussion today, have a couple of interesting claim scenarios, and it'd be interesting to see if other members of the group are seeing similar instances. Content tracking tools or contact tracing tools, methods for clients. I know we've discussed phone apps and Wi-Fi tracking to prevent, folks from congregating in the building, self-enforcement. Return to office conversations with colleagues. We've talked about colleagues being aggressive and different requirements, ruffling some feathers internally. And second, I received an email from two new OSHA enforcement policies that have changed. I'm happy to, I don't know much about it, but we can also pivot to that. So I'll let a couple more come in, but it looks like 50% would like to discuss claims updates, interesting claims or scenarios for the group. Another 50% with communication strategies with clients and their customers. And I will bundle that with the moving towards stage two, since those are pretty similar. So it looks like communication strategies and moving towards stage two is up there with the claims update. So let's take those first, and we will, I encourage everyone to be active. We want to keep a little bit more of an open conversation and dialogue this time around. And with that, I'll kick it to Michael Rivas, our chair, and Jen Weathersby. Thanks.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate that. So in regards to the claims and some interesting claims scenarios, 72%, want to talk about various claims. One of the things that we're starting to see is it's one issue to understand the client-specific policy and the language that's included within that policy. And then depending on the state that client is working in, the governor may put in new laws that all of a sudden through an executive order, it's now exposing our clients to a different aspect of compliance that they weren't aware of before. I know here in Illinois, there was an executive order pretty much prohibiting, civil liability unless there was some gross negligence. And we really thought a lot of our healthcare clients were going to stay away or be able to head off a lot of the professional liability claims when it comes to the geriatric residents passing away. Now, I know it's Illinois, so I kind of figured we would still get a lawsuit sometime. I really wasn't expecting it until July or August. Congratulations, we got it last week. So we're a little ahead of the curve there. That's wonderful. And they were able to tie the two together, at least in what their petitioner's attorney believes, that they have a solid case that it was neglect, right, in not treating the resident for the coronavirus or so forth. So just wanted to throw it out to the group. What are some interesting claim scenarios? We understand it may cross different lines of coverage. And then how are you addressing those various scenarios? So with that, I'll open it up. Unless Jen, you had another thought to add to this. I know you helped us put together this survey.
No, mostly just be what we're seeing on the workers' comp front, which I think can come later. I'm actually interested to hear if other folks have some, interesting kind of emerging different things that are coming forth from a claim standpoint.
Well, 72% and nobody has anything to say. I know Gwyneth does.
This is Jamie Glanz with Assurance. And we recently just saw a couple lawsuits filed against employers. One was filed by a group of employees from McDonald's under civil lawsuit alleging failure to provide the appropriate personal protective equipment and endangering the families of the employees. So be interested to see what happens on that front, on the civil front, but whether or not workers' comp exclusive remedy will apply to any of those suits.
So what we've heard in New Jersey with regards to business interruption claims, our clients are being clients and prospects, from what I understand, are being advised by CPAs and attorneys to go ahead and file a claim for business interruption just so that they can hold their spot in case that the carriers decide that they're going to remove the virus and bacteria exclusion and pay these claims. So we're seeing a flood of claims starting to come in to report just so that we can hold their spot. That's what I hear. So I find that very interesting.
So Gwyneth, working with Jamie Glanz at Assurance, we went ahead and promoted that in the beginning as well. If you want to make sure that you hold your spot. But Jamie, correct me if I'm wrong, last we checked though, only 11%, is that right, of clients have reported or?
Yeah, as of last week, only 11% of our clients had reported claims despite all of our, all of our recommendations and all the campaigns we've had to get those reported. And the thing that I think is really interesting about that is there's a case right now that, or there's a request right now for a multi-district litigation, which would essentially combine similar policies and similar insureds and have a ruling. So I would think most insureds would want to get their cases in so that they're holding their spot, so that they don't run into any consent issues. But we're just not seeing the volume of claims being submitted right now.
So this is Heather from Connor Strong. We wanted to avoid an E&O on our part. So if clients said they had a claim, even if there was a clear exclusion on the policy, we submitted the claim. And I would say, you know, we have probably 70% the carriers have responded to those claims with requests for information. So even though there was a virus exclusion, they're requesting additional information for the clients to submit so that they can take a coverage position. I think that arose after some of the early claims alleged bad faith for failure to investigate the claim. So I think the carrier's response has been to sort of investigate and do their investigation through a request for information. What I found interesting about the multi, we're seeing clients now get, I don't know if you guys have seen, I know I've shared it with the CIAB, so I'm sure they can put it on the working group too. I'm in the legal roundtable working group as well, but class actions, like that multi-district litigation, but then there's the firms that are actually doing direct solicitation to people who have losses. So our casino clients, our hospitality clients are getting these solicitations to join the class action. And advising around that has been tricky. Has anybody else been asked by clients whether they should join or, you know, join the class action?
Yeah, this is Matt with True North. We've had one client in the hospitality arena that was approached by a plaintiff's law firm, and same question about whether they should join the class action or not. And they hadn't even allowed the insurance company to come to their coverage determination yet, and they were almost looking to force the denial so that they could jump on. We coached them to allow the claim to play out, provide the information that they're requesting, and also brought our in-house counsel in on the response. But we have seen a little bit of that.
Yeah, it's a tricky situation, right? Because I don't want to discourage anybody from exercising their legal rights. But then some of these law firms are not who I would choose to represent me if I wanted to, you know, make a case of cases. These are like law firms that never did property coverage in their life. And now they're like leading. And so Matt, we've tried to do a similar thing, come up with like a list of questions for them to ask the attorney, like, how many cases have you been successful in handling first party property losses? What's your experience with the loss of market exclusion on a policy? Have you been successful in litigating around it and establishing BI losses? So we made them very pointed questions. But it is becoming more challenging in that realm.
Yeah, I agree. As we've started to ask some of those questions, and our client hasn't made the choice either way, but they have come to their own conclusion that likely they're going to have a higher chance of success and better outcome if they pursue it on their own versus joining a class action. But again, waiting for the insurance company in the situation to let it play out.
Yeah, and I just don't see how I don't know how it satisfies the class action requirements. So to me, that's the other question. It's not like you don't have to join today in order to protect your rights. Because if they get class action certification, then you have a right to opt in or opt out. So like to me, you don't necessarily need to incur the expense. Because even though they do it on a contingency fee, in most of these cases, they're saying you'll pay for the expense. So we've also asked the question, like, will you get the option to, like, what's your say in strategic decisions? What's your say in, like, experts that you would engage? So we've sort of tried to, similar to you, let them come to the conclusion that it's better to do it alone right now and sort of sit back and wait.
Yeah, we've also, in addition to that, that's a great recommendation. It's also, if they're looking for a formal coverage opinion, maybe looking to find an attorney that's played on both sides of the fence as well, that could give them an objective view that's been maybe has defended both insurance companies and plaintiffs in the past and is a specialist in this coverage area.
Good recommendation. interesting thing, I know I mentioned this last time, but I'm wondering if, and I'm seeing it specifically with Safety National, taking the position that they're not sure on the workers' comp policy, they're not sure if they're going to apply the communicable disease one retention. And they're sort of like hedging their bet, saying that they're not sure it's the same strand of virus. Has anybody else seen that?
Not seen that.
Okay.
Are they sending that in a coverage position, or is that just what the adjusters are sharing, or where are you getting that from, Safety Corporate, or where are you seeing that from?
Safety Corporate via email.
Okay.
And they took it on sort of like, it's not like a formal coverage position, but they're basically saying, we're going to wait and see. We can't confirm that we're going to apply one retention.
Okay. That's good to know. I'll see if we have any other updates from any of our carriers on that end.
I mean, I think you read the endorsement, and I just don't know how they get around it, but be interesting. My understanding is Safety National does a lot of the public entity pool business and hospitals, and so they're probably going to be hit pretty hard on the workers' comp.
Right.
Great. Thank you so much for that. Give a couple more seconds for people to chime in with any coverage, claims, questions, interesting stories. But let's move towards, and I'd like to hear from members of the group about moving towards stage two. Again, 22 states are in some version of this. Many or others are looking at June 1. For those that are and that have been able to get on the field or and work with clients and are beginning to reopen, what are some liability uncertainties that your clients have come across? And is anyone using any guidelines or best practices when working with these clients that are making that strategic decision to reopen?
Okay.
This is Tim, and I'm in New York. So late last week or middle of last week, the state put out guidelines for each of the industries that are reopening. And kind of has a must do and should do guidance for retail, for wholesale, for construction. So I've been leaning on those heavily because they're coming from the state. So I just point to those. They're really good sheets. I know, you know, not all of you are in New York, but I thought they were well done and, you know, could be used as a baseline.
Yeah, same here. This is Nick. I'm in California. Same year, we have statewide industry guidance that just came out over the past week or week and a half. And it's a collaboration between the state plan, Cal OSHA, and the California Department of Public Health. They put these guidelines together, and they're pretty extensive. The restaurant ones, I think, about 12 pages long. And that's kind of the sentiment we're getting from clients right now is they're grateful to have the guidance, but it's just so many hurdles. It's a lot to think about in reopening. I know a lot of our restaurant groups are kind of slow playing it, see how things work out, and really take the time to focus on delivery and takeout until they see how things play out. So there's a lot of confusion, I think, both nationally, since we don't have formal regulations from OSHA. And so it's creating more uncertainty of what do I have to do versus what's recommended. But where we've tried to shift the focus is you not only do this for your employees, but protect the safety of your customers. I mean, this is all public guidance. And so if you're not adhering to it, I mean, clients, customers, they're going to know that. And so it's definitely a rough situation to be in, but we're trying to keep them focused not just on the employees, but the safety of the public as well.
Nick, given that you're in California, I know California has its own, you know, phases and regulations as far as our guidance for opening up. But then Jen and I were talking maybe within the last week or so about San Diego putting in some different guidance or a little bit more stringent guidance for those businesses that were opening up. How are you strategizing to stay on top of that?
It's hard. We're a little smaller shop, and so I've only got one loss control guy on staff here, and so we're doing our best to stay in tune with the local guidance. I mean, we're really focused on the statewide guidance. That's kind of our guiding light at this point, but we're doing our best to communicate and encourage our clients to not only look at state and national guidance, but your local city ordinances as well, because we have seen like certain counties and even cities differ. So there's big recommendations across the board for face coverings, but there are certain cities that are requiring all people wear face coverings or just essential employees wear face coverings. We're doing our best, but we're just trying to urge our clients to kind of take it upon themselves to stay in touch with their local guidelines as well.
Thanks, Nick. Is anybody else struggling as we reopen up to, I guess, if you've got clients across the nation, just the various different state levels? And then I guess strategies to stay on top of, you know, what state's allowing what. I know we have some clients in Ohio, and apparently if you live in Ohio and you leave the state, when you come back, you have to self-quarantine for 14 days. So if you live on the border and work in a neighboring state, I guess every time you go to work, you have to come back and quarantine. I don't get it yet. But is anybody else struggling with staying abreast of that?
Yeah, it's something that we're, as we look at our reentry into our building, but also our client visits, taking a look at. It's challenging. We have we have a large transportation book of business, so we are crisscrossing the map quite a bit and trying to figure out where you can travel and can't travel, and is it best to maybe limit it to you know, car and that type of transportation,
or allowing fly.
Those are things that we're still looking at. I haven't found the best resource, so if anybody has an idea, that'd be great.
The CIAB state, they have a state-by-state tracker that tracks all the state orders, which are really good and helpful. So, and they get updated on a nightly basis. So if people aren't looking at those, I found them really helpful and send those to clients commonly. Like, our clients are finding those extremely helpful. So, and then OSHA obviously issued something which was not as helpful as one would have hoped. But I will say this, that for those, we have clients asking us, like, if I do this and I'm in violation of an order, will I have coverage? The governor of Pennsylvania about a week ago issued a directive, which I thought is very helpful to point to customers, so you don't have to say it. It's the governor saying it. He basically said, if you open in violation of our order, you will not, most likely will not have insurance coverage because you have an intentional violation of the law exclusion on all your policies. So I've been using that in my talking points with customers to say, you know, these governors are following one another, but this is important guidance by Governor Wolf. So you should know that, you know, if you violate it, you probably won't have coverage, because I think his analysis is probably accurate. The other thing we're struggling with as an agency, but also for our, what I call white collar operations, is most of the states, at least in the Northeast, even as they continue to move through the various phases in reopening, even in the lightest reopening, the orders are saying, if you've been able to work effectively remotely during this time, you must continue to work remotely. So, like, even though businesses are opening, the orders are still saying that if you've been working remotely, you need to continue working remotely. So that's something that we're struggling with.
Yeah, this is Henry. I'm going to give 2 minutes of my input for the time that I'm on the session, because I missed the last 28 minutes, so hopefully I can get my points in before I phase out again. But I think the issues that we're struggling with, and apologize if this has already been brought up, is our clients are saying they're just having issues getting their workers back in the workforce because of some of the Paycheck Protection Acts and some of the unemployment that they're receiving. So in a lot of cases, and workers are making more than they were, especially in the hospitality industry, than when they had their jobs. So they're saying, well, what can I do now? My workers don't want to come back to work. What can I do? Can I terminate them? Can I force them to come back? And so we're dealing with those issues. And the second part of it is the liability issue of what happens when people come onto our premises and they say they contract the virus. They're asking us for definitive opinions on whether that's covered or not. And we found a lot of exclusions buried in a lot of different policies, but our clients are asking for definitive opinions up front, even before they reopen. So those are two major issues that we're dealing with right now.
Henry, and I'll add a third to your list because I agree with both those issues. And the third issue is as these states are changing the workers' comp compensability standard, people are saying, why would I bring my workers back when now I'm going to be liable under workers' comp for COVID-19?
Right.
Because up until now, it hasn't been compensable, but California changed the law, and there's a bunch of other states that are considering changing the law. So I would add that as a third, if you don't mind me tacking on.
Sure.
What are the exclusions that you're seeing? What do they typically read like for the GL?
They're virus exclusions hidden in different languages in the policy. Somewhere down, I mean, we had to really search for one. I won't name the carrier, but it was some obscure exclusion buried deep in the policy that was a viral exclusion on the liability policy. And we researched and found it on several of our clients' policy. And we found it out because one of our agents had told a client that, sure, you'd be covered. And, you know, when they pursued it, we found out that they really weren't. And we didn't even know that exclusion existed on the policy.
Yeah, we started noticing those exclusions probably about a month ago as clients started to call us. But like Hartford, I would say Hartford.
See, I wasn't even going to say it.
Well, they're on every one. And I've already, and I will say this, we've already confirmed that they would not remove it even if you asked 3 years ago. So they started putting it on their policy 3 years ago. It's on every single one of their policies. So they tell us. So Hartford is a carrier. Others put it in the mold, mildew, fungi exclusion endorsement, which right. is like nowhere where I would have thought that it would be. But and I don't even know if it would be applicable. And then the other word you need to search for is microorganism. So there's a microorganism exclusion on these policies as well that someone could possibly cite to. It's a struggle though, Henry. I agree with you that I think as businesses open and they ask that, especially as you start to talk about contact tracing and people be able to trace where they contracted it, this is going to be a huge issue. And it's a huge, I'm speaking as the general counsel of a brokerage company, it's a huge E&O issue for us brokers.
Yes.
Yes.
Thanks,
so,
for that.
Henry.
Thanks,
So Henry, when you are being asked about, you know, to give an opinion as to whether or not the liability coverage is going to be there, how are you guys responding or handling that? I would assume you'd have to take it on a case by case basis, but generally the answer is probably going to be doubtful.
Yeah, we had to go to our legal counsel and draft some letters with some specific language that basically says, you know, we can't give you any type of opinion or be your advocate until you file a claim. So we're advising that our clients file a claim, and then we'll research the policy language and advocate you from that perspective. We're trying not to, from an E&O perspective, give any definitive answers up front without having a claim situation that we're trying to address. So at least that's how we're dealing with it. Even though it puts us in a precarious situation, because as you all know, our clients look for us and look to us for our guidance, and they want to know some of these answers up front. And unfortunately, you know, because of the exposure, we're just in a situation where we can't give any definitive answers in a lot of these spaces. So it's really changed the way that we have worked and advocated for our clients. In the past, you know, we would have thought we wouldn't give second thoughts really about some of the things that we advise on. But in this pandemic situation, we're really having to rethink how we engage with our clients, both from a risk control and a claim consulting perspective, because, you know, lawsuits are flying like crazy already. And so we know they're coming. We're just trying not to make them worse. I'd be curious to know how other people are solving for that.
Henry, the one thing I encouraged our clients to look at, there was a golf course in California or in Florida that is having patrons sign a COVID-19 specific release of liability. And so for our hospitality clients, I sort of sent, it was online, so I sent a link, it wasn't a client, the Florida golf course. I sent a link to that to some customers who were asking to say, you know, we cite the virus exclusion and all of that, but I say you can avoid liability, possibly you want to speak to your legal counsel, but there's the assumption of risk doctrine, but also look at this, what one Florida golf course is doing.
That's a
good solution. I don't know if they're enforceable, but that's what I've been doing.
That's a good idea.
All right. Well, it looks. Feel free to chime in, but let's move on. So this we've been focused a little bit more on clients and third parties opening up. Let's shift that to internal decisions. You know, for those that have opened up, have you been doing on site visits? How have those companies responded? And for those that are sticking to a virtual environment, are there any tools that you are currently vetting or using for, you know, virtual site inspections and whatnot? Feel free to, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Hey, Rob, I think if we break this up a little bit. So has anybody's corporate office opened up internally, I guess, just for your organization? And then if so, how have you managed that reopening process to let your own staff back in?
At True North, we
this
are.
Is Jen.
Go ahead, Jen.
I was just going to say we are over several different counties. Our offices in Northern California, and they've all reopened sort of at different phases. Some of the more rural counties, we've already had 5 of our offices open. We're still waiting for the other 6. Sacramento, the county stay-at-home order expired Friday night. So we are actually physically starting to reopen our corporate office, and our biggest office will be on June 3rd. The way we've kind of handled it is we've already done preliminary looking at what employees don't have a hindrance to returning to work, you know, maybe childcare issues or underlying health conditions or things like that. And so we've had each of the supervisors and managers have one-on-one conversations to determine circumstances. And then from that spreadsheet of our employees across all the offices, we've kind of learned that it's going to allow us to reopen in phases anyway, because not all of our employees actually can come back. But it is interesting that our leadership has made the decision to open in the face of California's executive order on workers' compensation presumption, because if we were to allow folks to continue to work remotely where they could, we technically wouldn't have that liability, but we are asking everybody that can come back to come back. So I think that's interesting. I don't know if anybody else has those challenges.
Yeah, we're opening on it in a phased manner as well. So we're starting with, we've had 2 employees in the offices, about 6 offices, and we've had 2 employees in a couple of our offices just to handle mail and incoming documents. And then we are starting a phased opening with people that need access to printers and things like that, and people who are having difficulty with internet connections are going back, and anybody who wants to go back. So they're starting with that list of people and making the decisions about how they're going to work. We have all been given the option to stay home if that works for us. It's working really well. I think it's been really surprising to our leadership how productive people have been working from home. And I think there's definitely interest in keeping some portion of the workplace at home, either on a permanent basis or at least several days a week. So we just had a survey that went out to the employees. You know, do you prefer 3 days in the office and 2 days at home or 2 days in the office? What, you know, so we're looking at what people's preferences are, but our leadership has certainly given us the option to stay at home if we choose. I'm also curious to hear about what other people are doing in terms of traveling to clients and what your corporate decisions have been around that. Because at this time, we're not traveling yet.
This is Tim with M&T. I just went to a construction site for the first time on Friday, and my plan with my team is to start doing construction site visits. Obviously, in the Northeast, this is prime time for construction. So we're going to start hitting construction sites in June, but won't go to manufacturing until probably at least July. Corporately, as long as we can drive in our own car and not spend the night someplace, we can make site visits, but no airfare, no hotels.
And what state is that in? What state are you doing the site visits?
So I'm in New York, and it's primarily Albany to Buffalo, upstate.
Oh.
Upstate, so not.
And for our offices that have opened, our risk personnel have done some site visits, client visits, training. But we're not allowed to have client visits internally to our offices.
Yeah, as far as visiting clients, we never stopped 100% going out to construction clients, considering their essential business. So throughout the duration of this, we've been going out. We've only had a couple of our safety advocates go out. So we have a pretty big team. Like on construction alone, it's probably like 5 or 6 of them. Only one or two felt comfortable going out in the beginning. After the first month, I think all but one is now going out and visiting. We plan on picking it up even more so in June. Regarding manufacturing, we helped a lot of our clients virtually, just by taking pictures and doing video chats and so forth to see what their, floor plans look like, creating some foot traffic patterns and their employee screening for coming on to work and so forth. Where we did that for, I want to say maybe for the first 6 weeks. And then last week, we actually started going out and verifying and working with them to ensure that they were putting those best practices in place. Where I think we're seeing our biggest hangup, though, isn't so much in our clients taking action to try and address or mitigate the COVID exposure, but it's in the documentation. So for some of our clients who have been cited by OSHA, when they've been asked, well, what are you doing to address these exposures? They can verbally tell you what they've done, but when we ask to actually see the response plans and, documentation, the action and the employee training, that's where a lot of the disconnect's been. I don't know if anybody else has anything else to add on top of that.
Hi, I'm new to the group. I'm Lori, and I'm from Murray Insurance. I'm out of Pennsylvania. And we have not opened yet. We are still in the red phase, so we probably won't go back into the office until next Friday, next week sometime, maybe the week after. But no client visits except to construction right now, because construction went back to work, as somebody else was saying about the Northeast. And so we are just kind of phasing back in, but mostly virtual stuff as of now.
So, Lori, you said in Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania is one of our states, the construction, when it reopened, they only allowed essential visitors to the site. You weren't allowed to have other vendors. Do you see them letting risk control onto construction sites?
Yes.
Because we were told that we weren't permitted because we're not an essential vendor.
They are, as long as you're following the provisions, wearing the mask, 6 feet distance. And they can't hold training, in a group.
Okay. But some major general contractors told us they wouldn't let risk control on the site because they didn't deem it in compliance with the governor's order.
As far as I know, we have made a visit or two, not a lot, but for the yellow counties, at least the ones that are working yellow counties now.
Okay, yellow, that makes sense.
So are you telling your folks to comply with whatever the clients asked them to do?
We're following the, as well as everyone else, the governor's orders. I mean, so Governor Wolf has basically made really good orders on, you know, the expectations for reopening in those areas. And so we are following, you know, what those expectations are for our clients, as well as, you know, our interaction with their sites. But yes, if they have specific requirements even above that, then we certainly won't go if they, you know, say that we're not allowed to go, and we're only going in certain circumstances if it's been requested and it follows the guidance of the governor.
Hey everybody, it's Bernadette. Just to tag on, we are reopening, so Monday and Tuesday will be our first, next Monday and Tuesday will be our first 2 days back in the office. I think following similar, I think to Jen, I mean, if there is an employee who has a reason that they cannot return, they are being asked to communicate that with their manager and also with HR, and each individual situation is being addressed. We are being asked to wear face coverings unless we are in an office where we can close our door. We cannot eat in the cafe. You can bring a lunch and eat at your desk, or you can warm up your lunch and go back to your desk. We had some concerns about, you know, the use of social areas in common areas, so restrooms and things like that. So there will be increased cleaning. We are going to be cleaning our desks more often also. I mean, just anything, I guess, that has the potential to create an environment where the virus could prosper, grow, whatever, be transmitted. So we are going back. No business travel if it's not approved by an office head or executive leadership. And if it is approved, it's only by auto. We will start allowing visitors back into our office based upon certain guidelines. So obviously they have to be asked a number of questions, have their temperature taken, and all of that good stuff. So that's what we're doing.
So one of the things that we had to look at when we reopened our office was if there was someone who was positive, how are we going to conduct our own internal contact tracing? Is that something that other offices have discussed?
Yeah, I'd say it's something that we've discussed, and I think there's various different methods or solutions that people are looking at. You can latch onto one of the platforms out there. Maybe it's a local medical provider that's providing it. I think United Healthcare also provides some type of platform that allows you to take temperatures and ask those questions and maybe push text messages to colleagues. We haven't gone that far. It's really everyone taking their own temperature before they leave home, asking them, you know, each of them asking themselves three different questions in the morning. You know, are they taking any fever reducing medication? Are they experiencing any symptoms? But we have not gone any further than that. I'd be curious if others are taking a more aggressive approach.
This is Tim in Florida. We do have a kiosk in our main office in Jacksonville that you have to do a facial scan, temperature. And then in our smaller offices, there's usually the receptionist is tasked with taking temperatures as we begin to phase back in. And if somebody spikes a fever, then they're not admitted into the suite. And then they're directed to HR to talk about who they've been in contact with.
We are definitely doing temperatures. So anything above 100.4, you will be asked to go home and contact your medical provider. So, and we're doing check it at home before you come in, but 100.4 is what we're using. And if you have that temperature, you will be asked to go home and contact your medical provider.
So I apologize. I know we're at the top of the hour. It could be 2 o'clock where you're at, could be 11. But I think I want to be respectful of everybody's time, so we'll wrap it up. Rob, do you have any last comments or plans to send out another survey for next meeting's topics?
Yes, I am opening up a poll right now, just based on how today went. I think we had plenty to talk about. Just would love to hear everyone's input on if we should continue these two-week calls, move it to every third week, monthly, other. In addition to that, we'll try to post this recording in the next couple days, as well as a brief recap. There was a good bit of interest on the state legal tracker, so I will post that in the Basecamp group as well. Feel free to reach out to me individually if you have any questions or with your login. I know we opened up the state resources, so it's not behind a firewall. So you should be able to access that. Looks like 81% would like to continue it. I also have an Outlook invite calendar I'm happy to share with the call-in details. We're going to continue sending out these registration emails just so we have a gist of who's registering. But it's also, you know, it's a good placeholder on your calendar if you just do the reoccurring event as well. Also, feel free to reach out to Michael and I with any questions, topics. You know, we have this polling feature, so it's a great way to get the, you know, the conversation started. So we'll continue to leverage this. So please feel free to reach out on any topics you'd like to discuss. And with that, thank you, everyone. Looking forward to speaking with everyone in 2 weeks, and I hope you have a great rest of your short week.
Take it easy.
Thanks, everyone.